Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:01 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 29th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I think we're also at the end of the second quarter, so it's not a bad time to be thinking about what's the second half of the year going to look like and where are we in terms of the bigger picture and the longer-term cycle. So I thought I'd like to start off this week and talk about the yield curve spread, because it's been in the news a lot recently. I remember back in 2005, there was a very similar discussion going on about whether it was going to be a reliable indicator on this particular occasion, because the global economy was firing on all cylinders. There was a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and you had the China was just surging onto the global stage. Its introduction into the World Trade Organization in 2001 really unleashed its manufacturing potential, and its consumption of commodities was surprising the entire world. And there was really nobody considering that there was going to be a big problem, and yet there was. This very big problem had emerged in U.S. property. Well, what about this occasion? Well, we know that the size of central bank balance sheets has gone up an awful lot, and we haven't been in this kind of situation before. So there is the potential that somewhere out there in the future horizon, there is a surprise lurking that has not yet been identified, or has been identified but is completely underappreciated. That is pretty much exactly the situation that we had back in 2005 and 2006. There were people that were concerned about the bubble that had arisen in U.S. housing, but it was just didn't seem to be a front page news item until it became the only news item that people were willing to talk about. So we know that the yield curve spread is contracting, and that we also know that from the underperformance of banking sectors that we have got tighter financial conditions. And when we look at it's the KBW NASDAQ banking sector, and this is the systemically important banks globally, that it's been ranging now for the better part of a decade, and it has now failed to sustain the move above 1,000 again, and it was in mildly positive territory in here today, but it has most definitely broken the progression of higher reaction lows since the middle of 2016, and this is at a minimum a medium-term corrective phase and potentially a medium-term peak within the context of a much lengthier base formation that's still in development. And that base formation has an amplitude of approximately 100% from trough to peak. And again, that is not overly surprising. But if we think about what kind of effect that has on trading sentiment, that it's attractive from a trader's perspective to short the rallies, to buy the dips, and to think that there is the potential at least to have a multi-year cyclical advance within the context of what is essentially a secular bear market. That the amount of risk that banks are taking on these days is substantially less than it was, and that is affecting their margins. But it is also important to look at the constituents of this index, because it is truly global, and obviously you have the big US banks, you have the big Japanese banks, the big Chinese banks, big European banks, and there are a substantial number of UK banks there as well. That is a testament to just how large the UK's financial industry is, and that is in the aftermath of the credit crisis and the almost complete nationalisation of Royal Bank of Scotland, for example. When we look at those individual banking sectors, then we get some additional intelligence, because the European Banking Index has been ranging in a similar manner to what it did before 1996. We had a substantial bull market in the late 1990s. We had an even bigger bull market from 2002 through to 2007, and that's over. And there is the significant potential that this index could be ranging for a prolonged period. Well, there is one caveat to that, and it is that the index does today is not the same as the index that we had back in the 80s and 90s. The constituents have changed practically beyond recognition. There are only two German banks that are listed today, and considering the health of Deutsche Bank, that is quite likely to at least to become the subject of a merger potentially with Commerzbank, or that it could be nationalized. Just about every other German bank has been nationalized, so there isn't there's anything other than an institutional decision is the only thing that's holding that back. Well, then if we look at the Chinese banking sector, well, Chinese banks are a little bit different because they are state-owned. And I'm just pulling the chart over to take away that spike at the beginning of the data. Well, we've had a substantial deterioration in the Chinese banking sector since the beginning of this year, and it is beginning to get alarming. And we saw the very first evidence of support starting to come through in here today after what has been a rather accelerating advance over the course of June. But this is not a big enough upward dynamic to even begin to question the downward bias overall. There is a very clear progression of lower rally highs, and that would have to be broken to even begin to question the potential for additional downside. Well, what's driving all of this? Well, China is. There are so many different strands to what's going on in China at the moment that I could spend the entire broadcast just simply talking about that. But I think that there are two things that really do come forward. One is the domestic outlook, and the other is the international outlook. The Communist Party has every intention of being around for the lengthy medium term. And Xi Jinping has every intention of being at the top of the Communist Party for as long as he survives. And that means that they have to keep any further control on the domestic economy. Well, one of the primary ways in which they've helped to raise people out of poverty and into the middle class is through the property market. And that is not dissimilar to what we've seen in the UK or in the USA. That getting on the property ladder is something that a lot of people in China have aspired to do, and a lot of people have succeeded in doing. And the merry-go-round has been underway now for a significant period of time. That the Chinese economy has gone an awfully long time without a recession. And part of the reason for that is because of the massive infrastructure build that we've had, and a lot of that has gone into residential property. There is no property tax in Australia, excuse me, there's no property tax in China. And what that I think means is that it's very easy to hold property and keep it vacant. Lots of people that I know, for example, have numbers of properties that are in the tens, and if not even in the hundreds of apartments, and they have absolutely no cost of carry because there's no tax. So that's a rather important characteristic, because the Chinese economy is now clamping, or the Communist Party is clamping down on the shadow banking sector. Now, the shadow banking sector is primarily focused on regional banks, and the vast majority of those regional banks are not listed. So we don't get an accurate reflection of the impact that that's having on the market by looking at individual shares. We can only think then of the stock market as a not even a second order, but probably even a tertiary way of thinking about the market. It's almost like a derivative of the primary market that's going on. So that's, I think, an important characteristic about the property market, for example, in the Shanghai Property Index, which is made up of developers. It has been trending lower, just like the banks, all of this year. The commonality tells us that the property market is as much entwined with the shadow banking sector as the banking sector is, and that is where the focus of tightening is underway. Well, obviously, the Chinese government does not want to get a property crash, and neither do they want to have a financial center crash. So it is inevitable at some stage that we do get some support coming in for the banking sector, but so far there's been little evidence of it. But we do have a short-term oversold condition, so we are approaching a period where we could get a bounce. And when we look at the H-share index, there is the potential that a bounce is now underway in Hong Kong, and that is now unwinding. I think or the I think the likelihood is that it is going to unwind that oversold condition relative to the trend mean, but that's only a very short-term consideration. The much more important medium-term consideration is that it has broken the progression of higher reaction lows evident over the last 2 years, that there has been a significant deterioration, and that it has a lot of work to do in order to demonstrate that it can sustain a move back above 12,000. And that is, I think, the minimum requirement to begin to give some credence to the view that we might return to a position of demand dominance beyond the short term. One encouraging point is that Tencent has bounced from the region of the trend mean in here today. So that is a trend that had lost its consistency at the penultimate high, and now we are in this lengthier period of ranging, and but so far we do not have evidence that this isn't top formation development. So this is an important level for Tencent, and it is a major constituent in the emerging markets index, not least because it's there on its own, but then you have Naspers, which has got a substantial shareholding in the company, is also in the emerging markets index. So and then also it was a totem for the stock market in during that acceleration that we saw in 2017. So if it does in fact sustain a move below that the trend mean, well, that is not going to be particularly good for sentiment in China. Well, if we think about I did say that there were two ways of thinking about what China is doing. One was the domestic, so they are certainly trying to ensure that some of the leverage comes out of the system, but that they do not create a crash. Then you have the external, and China has got a military base now in Pakistan and in Sri Lanka and Djibouti, so it is creating almost a breadcrumb trail of military bases between Middle Eastern oil and China. So they're looking at securing their supply routes, and that's in many respects, that was the role that the U.S. military had ensured for much of the last half a century. And by becoming more assertive is a kind term, aggressive is another, on the international front, well, that is also designed to play well at home, where they can demonstrate to the middle classes that China is now a global power, and try to, I think, increase nationalistic fervor. In a command economy which has national socialist tendencies, such as China, where the private sector is largely subject to the communist administration and is really only tolerated to the extent that it is a function of the wider party's plans for increasing power, then there is the potential that we are now seeing the South China Sea being claimed by China, that Vietnam is a very interesting at a very interesting point right now, because the market had done spectacularly well in 2016 and 2017, and it is now trading below the trend mean. But the much bigger picture is that there is oil and natural gas off the shore of Vietnam, and China wants it. And the Vietnamese government is a communist party, and they want to introduce the same kind of, I think, restrictions on personal freedom, such as restrictions on internet usage, and they want to create their own giant firewall that they already have in China, and that is not playing particularly well with the Vietnamese population. So that is a potential flashpoint. There is, of course, the potential that having claimed the South China Sea, that China will then decide to do the same thing with other parts of the world. This is not dissimilar to National Socialism and how Germany thought of the Sudetenland. So, therefore, we need to be at least pay some attention to what China is doing abroad, as both a viewpoint on how it sees the international order, and both and then how that can be used to cement control of the domestic front. And that is all happening against a background where we have a crisis of, well, I think it's an identity crisis in much of the West. People are still navel-gazing at the rise of populism, and they don't seem to have any real recognition that it is a reaction against the status quo. Well, what I found particularly interesting in here this week was the decision by the Italian, well, the new Italian administration to prioritize immigration. So yields have started to come back down. When they started talking about changing fiscal rules, well, then that was when the yields went from negative to positive in a very short period of time. But now what they are doing is essentially a bait and switch operation, and they are prioritizing immigration and saying very little indeed about the outlook for their fiscal plans. And part of the reason for that is because this year Italy has got an enormous amount of debt that needs to be refinanced, second only to the USA. And they need to be able to do that at accommodative rates. So we can anticipate that the fiscal discussion is probably going to be delayed until they have greater, I think, visibility on just how their refinancing operations are going. Then, if we look at Germany. Well, Germany has got a great deal of debt outstanding, and it has got so much debt, and yet if we look at the sovereign curve, it is trading at negative yields all the way out to between 7 and 8 years. So that's really quite an incredible situation. And the ECB is talking about reducing the size of its purchases to zero in September. And the pace with which the size of its balance sheet has been expanding over the course of this year has certainly moderated, and it's likely to stop in just 2.5, 3 months' time. So that is going to remove a source of demand for German bunds. And if we look at, for example, the 5 year, we can see that Germany has been able to borrow for a prolonged period at negative interest rates. So people have literally been paying Germany to take their money. And that has afforded the German economy an incredible amount of largesse. And yet the DAX index, having outperformed for much of the last few years, is struggling now to hold this move above 12,000. And so far, it's been able to hold it, but I don't think anyone is going to be too surprised if people start to call this chart pattern a head and shoulders, or that people start to question whether the 12,000 is going to continue to hold. The real possibility is that Germany is going to not be able to enjoy negative interest rates for all that much longer if the ECB stops buying them. And That's going to have some knock-on effects, not least for the periphery, because all of the peripheral bonds in the Eurozone are spread over bunds, and the fact that they've been able to hold down their yields is in large part due to the fact that Germany is still trading at negative yields. Even Italy was trading at negative yields on 2 years until May. So we're in a rather extraordinary condition in Europe. And I think that there is a very large question as to whether the ECB will in fact be able to remove its quantitative easing program. I think that they're probably going to get a rude awakening when they eventually do stop making their purchases. But the euro was a bit stronger in here today because of the immigration pact that Europe agreed to. And that is, in many respects, an appeasement of the populist rising. That you have had a lot of anger among the populations of Europe about the handling of the migrant issue, and now you're getting a populist, I think, reaction to that sense of anger. But again, it's a bait and switch operation. That this is appeasing the populist rhetoric. It is not really dealing with the root causes. And the root causes are simple. That in Europe, the UK, and the USA, what has happened with both the deflationary impact of technological innovation and the adoption of globalization, that domestic jobs, in particularly in manufacturing, have been sacrificed in return for cheap imports. And the primary beneficiaries of that have been businesses. And now you're getting a reaction against that from just regular people, that the numbers of people who've been left behind by globalization have risen to such an extent that they now have critical mass to change electoral outcomes. Well, the euro was up by about a cent in here today, and it has paused around this, well, just above the 115 area. So I think the odds of it being able to sustain a move at least back up towards the trend mean are improving. But again, it does have a lot of work to do if it's going to be able to do more than that. The dollar has been resurgent over the last while, and the Australian dollar was also in mildly positive territory in here today. But bigger picture, this has broken the progression of higher reaction lows, and it has encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. So it does now look like a short the rallies rather than a buy the dips kind of market. And that has boosted the nominal value of the stock market. We've seen that in Australia, where the market was a little bit weaker today on a stronger dollar, and it's been stronger because of the weaker dollar. That's exactly what we saw in Japan, most particularly a couple of years ago when the yen really started to weaken in 2013 through 2015. Well, the Nikkei is back in the region of its trend mean, and this looks like a pretty orderly consolidation. But perhaps the I think it's not perhaps, it's definitely the most important level here is 20,000. On each occasion since 1992, when the index got up to 20,000, it subsequently made a new low. And that pretty much stopped in 2014, or excuse me, 2016. And now it has held the progression of higher reaction lows since. So as long as it is holding that 20,000 level, we can give the benefit of the doubt to a new secular bull market. And I think that that is a profound change for Japan. It was interesting today that Tokyo CPI was in positive territory, that the job openings are rising, and the unemployment is at the lowest level since the late 1980s. So Japan's economy is primed for inflation, and it's really only a matter of time before we start to get wage demands coming through. And it may not even be wage demands, but it might be wage pressures just to encourage workers to change jobs or to come back into the workforce. What I've definitely seen, I've been to Japan now twice in the last 18 months, and I've seen a lot more women working, most particularly in what would have been considered labor-intensive or heavy lifting jobs, I think is probably the best way to think about it, that you have women that are delivering kegs of beer and you have women working as porters in hotels. And I haven't seen women doing that kind of work anywhere else. Then the number of foreign workers that you now have in Japan is considerably larger than I think many people imagine. There has been this long institutional viewpoint that Japan would never allow inflation, that it was one of the most xenophobic and monocultural countries in the world. But I can definitely attest to the fact that there are foreign workers everywhere in Japan, and that number is rising. The restrictions on immigration and work visas have been very quietly dropped, and the numbers of immigrants are rising considerably. And young people moving in and helping to fill some of those empty positions is also positive for economic growth because it represents a revitalization of the domestic population. That's an important characteristic of this market, that some of the long-term deflationary, I think, factors that contributed to an awfully long period of underperformance are now disappearing and are not being reported on the way I think they probably deserve. And but the most important thing is that the index has held the move above 20,000, and as long as it is sustaining that move, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Well, we know that if we think about the kinds of things that could potentially signal the next recession, well, one of them is the yield curve spread, and that's why I wanted to lead off with it because it's getting so much additional commentary right now. Well, then you have the high yield spreads, and when you look at high yield spreads in the USA, well, they haven't been doing anything for an awfully long time. I will put that chart up in a moment, but European high yield spreads are trending higher, and that's different. And what it suggests is that liquidity conditions are already tightening in Europe, and that we already know that the ECB is gearing up to stop its quantitative easing program. So if we start to see this yield pushing above the 500 basis point level, and that is not such a big ask based on the trajectory of the spread right now, well, we can anticipate that Europe is going to have a growth problem, that there is going to be an issue for the high yield sector, and that it could feed through into the banking sector, and the banking sector is already underperforming. Well, let's look at US high yield spreads, and they have now broken out. So this is quite clearly different. We have not seen this before. This has been a particularly inert chart for much of the last 18 months, and when it was last updated yesterday, it was at a new recovery high. So this is, well, it's testing the high when we look at it on the daily chart, but it would have to pull back in a rather dynamic fashion now to question potential that this isn't breaking higher. Well, it is not a the fact that if it breaks higher is not something that's going to signal that there is a recession risk imminently. But if it trends higher and trends higher for upwards of 6 months, then that will be an indication that financial conditions are underperforming, that financial conditions are not just getting tight, but they're turning into a headwind. And then if we look at the US banking sector, well, it was at a new reaction low yesterday, but it did bounce somewhat in here today. But I think the most important point is not so much that it bounced, but that it gave up the entire advance. So this is important, that one of the reasons that we look at banks is that bull markets thrive on liquidity. and banks are liquidity providers. So when banks are underperforming, it tells us that liquidity is tightening. And if liquidity is tightening, then that's a time that we need to pay particular attention to the consistency of trends. Well, when we look at the S&P 500 Banks Index, it is now below the trend mean. If we get downside follow-through next week, well, that will begin to question part of the rationale that was behind this really impressive rally that we had from the beginning of 2016. Most particularly after the presidential election at the end of 2016, we had enthusiasm about tax cuts and about the repatriation of overseas earnings, and then the growth spurt that both of those things would entail, the fact that higher interest rates from the Fed would create better margins for the banking sector. And that was all supposedly going to contribute to outsized dividend payments. Well, the upshot of the stress tests was that the Federal Reserve has reduced what JP Morgan was going to pay out. It's still a rather impressive sum, but it is a reduction. Both Goldman and Morgan Stanley have had to hold their dividend payouts, and Deutsche Bank failed. Well, it is interesting that they used that it was a foreign bank failed and all the domestic banks passed the stress tests. Then that's an important consideration, because what it's also saying is that the Fed is looking most closely at the biggest banks, and we already know that the systemically important banks globally are underperforming. So when we look at JP Morgan's chart pattern, well, then it did pop on the upside in early trading, but it was not able to hold it. And I think that this is important, that there is the potential here that banks are moving into a position of underperformance once more. Goldman Sachs has been trending lower since the peak back in March. Now, it is coming back down towards an area of previous support, but it has also encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. So this is a downtrend. And the best we could say is that there's short-term scope for a bounce. So I think when we think about it in those terms, I think we have to begin to consider that the signal that the market is sending us is that credit conditions are tightening. And when we think about it in those terms, junk bond yields do look like they're rising. So therefore, junk bond prices should be breaking down. And that is what's happening, that we have this rolling over top formation that is almost slow motion in terms of its duration, but looks like a first step below the peak of the rally that we had, or the top formation we had between 2011 and 2015. And the most likely trajectory is downwards. So it looks like high yield bonds are going to be a really bad place to be for the foreseeable future. And junk bonds trade like equities. So we should perhaps then keep an eye on what's going on in the wider market. Well, there is no denying that the pace of the advance picked up on Wall Street in the towards the end of last year, and that we had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and the index has bounced from the region of the trend mean now on three separate occasions. Well, it was in mildly positive territory in here today, but the much bigger picture is that it needs to hold the region of the trend mean. And as long as it is doing that, well, then we can conclude that this is a benign environment and that this is nothing more than a medium-term correction. Well, medium-term corrections can last for anything from 6 to 18 months. One of the more bullish facts that we have right now is that indices like the Russell 2000 or the NASDAQ 100 have broken up to new high ground and have so far held those advances. And as long as both small caps and big cap tech are doing that, well, it's going to be difficult to make the argument that we are in a bear market environment. So That's one of the more bullish facts that you have right now. And the big question that is outstanding on this market is the extent to which banks are going to underperform. If banks don't just move into a more volatile trading range, but if they start to trend lower, then that is going to act as a headwind for the wider market. Now, something that I think is beginning to be realized by investors is that the rhetoric around trade wars is something that is going to ebb and flow, and not least because it plays well with disaffected people, voters, and the people who feel disenfranchised by the growth of globalization. So that's going to represent an additional risk premium on the market. We could have got we did go for years without ever really having to talk about politics. That obviously both David and I have got strong political views, but you never really there wasn't a market reason to really get involved with the political discourse. But now there is. And what that represents is an additional risk premium. When you didn't have to worry about something before, and you most definitely have to worry about it now, then that means you have an additional risk premium. Well, one of the benefits for the technology sector, most particularly companies like Google and Amazon and Netflix and Facebook and Twitter, is that they don't have Chinese operations. So they are largely removed from any risk from a trade war. But companies like Apple do. Apple both manufactures in China and also sells a substantial number of its phones in China. So that does have risk here that it could pull back. But there is, I think, very little evidence just yet that it's anything other than a pause and a consolidation. I think that we know that we're in the latter stages of a medium-term advance. And there is no secular bull market that is not punctuated by recessions. The next recession does not necessarily have to be a crash. We have been conditioned to expect crashes because we had two in the space of a decade. And people are worried about what the normalization of policy is likely to eventually mean. We are now in a period of quantitative tightening. And the central bank total assets chart is contracting. So that's an additional sign that we are in a period where we have some money getting taken off the table. Another barometer for the health of the global economy is South Korea. People tend to think a lot about the G10, but South Korea is the 11th largest economy in the world, and it's one of the world's biggest exporters, and the market is underperforming. It is now coming right back down to the lows we saw last year, and best case scenario is that this is a first step above that long range that we saw from the peak back through, well, from the peak in 2011 through to 2017. If this is just a first step above that range, well, then that would be a very benign environment. But if it is, then it's going to have to find support soon. And it is also interesting that the Korean won has broken down, having spent most of the year so far being really one of the most inert of all currencies. It broke down in the last couple of weeks. But it's still within a range that's been going on now for 8 years. So the much more important level for the won is 1200, and if it were to weaken through that, then that would be, I think, rather a headwind for the South Korean stock market, and what that would potentially signify for the export market would be that we're in a more difficult period of global growth. What is important that last year we were talking about synchronized a return to synchronized global economic expansion. It was South Korea had a negative quarter in the last quarter of last year. So heading into this year, we didn't quite have synchronized global growth. But and we're still in a point where the vast majority of economies are still expanding. But I think there are risks starting to mount as to how long that is sustainable for. Well, when we start to compare the various different markets, we can clearly see that there's relative strength in Wall Street and the dollar has been resurgent. And it has been strong against just about everything. And so far, the dollar index is consolidating above the trend mean, and the dollar hasn't quite held all of its advance in here this week. But this does look like a break of the trend down from the peak from early 2017. So it does look like we're going to see additional dollar strength over the medium term. And that has weighed on the gold price in dollars. Gold was marginally steadier here around the $1,250 area today, but it really does need to bounce in a dynamic manner to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I have commented on more than one occasion that there is this saucering pattern evident in the gold price evidence since 2013, and that generally speaking, when you get a saucering chart pattern, it's a base formation in development. But it does need to hold that progression of higher major reaction lows, and we are testing that the most recent of those now. So if gold is going to rally, this is about where it really does need to do so. And silver prices had broken down earlier this week and were again in marginally positive territory today, but they really do need to sustain the move up and through $17.50 to break that more than 2 year progression of lower rally highs. And but I'm reasonably encouraged that we're going to have some kind of dynamic move in silver in the not too distant future, because it is historically uncharacteristic for silver to trade in such an inert manner. It has pulled back though from the upper side of the range in a dynamic manner twice in the last couple of months, and it really does need to follow through on the upside next week to confirm a failed downside break on the lower side of the range. Well, failed breaks tell us that the are well, when you get a range, it erodes supply above and demand below the market. If we get failed breaks, it tells us that the vacuum of supply above the market has not formed. If we get a failed downside break, it tells us that the vacuum of demand below the market has not formed. So, if we do get upside follow-through next week, then we can begin to think that there is demand coming back in at higher levels. Then it is only a question of how long does it take for that surplus of supply above the market to be completely eroded. So we are at a very interesting juncture, because silver is not going to range between $16 and $17 indefinitely. Eventually, it's going to break out, and when it does so, it's going to move in a very dynamic manner. Then, in fact, that is part of the reason that people trade the precious metals, is because when they do break out, they really do tend to run. And platinum prices are certainly suffering from the lack of demand from the diesel sector, and they're back down towards the $850 area. Well, $850 is not so far away from the lows we saw in 2016 and again in 20 sorry in 2008, and the price has come back in a rather aggressive manner over the last few weeks. One thing we can say about all the precious metals is that there is a short-term oversold condition. So, even in a bear market environment, then there is the potential for a bounce to come through in the precious metal markets. But there is the bigger picture, and when we think about what's going on out there in the world, with China becoming more aggressive on the international front, and the big questions that are outstanding about debt and where exactly are bond yields going to go, well, then gold does tend to do best when you get an inflationary scare, but central banks are not raising interest rates aggressively. We just don't have that right now. the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates without the clear evidence that inflation is a problem. And the 10-year Treasury yield has been firming from the 3% level for much of the last few months now. When we look at this on a much longer term scale, well, we can see that it has been trending lower for an awfully long time, and there has certainly been a hiatus over the course of the last 7 years. But it really does need to sustain a move up and away from that 3% level to confirm a return to supply dominance. And with tightening credit conditions and the relative difference in yield between the USA and everywhere else, as well as the relative strength of the dollar, all of those factors have contributed to the bond prices finding support. If we start to see the dollar weakening, and against a background where there is a lot of additional supply, well, that would be a different story. On one factor, we know that the strength of the dollar has certainly weighed on the Asia dollar index, for example. Asian currencies have pulled back rather violently against the US dollar, and that has had a knock-on effect for the ASEAN sector. It isn't simply that China has been under pressure, but ASEAN generally has been pulling back in a violent manner. The Latin American dollar index was also at new lows and was additionally weak in here today. Mexico is the latest country to have the potential for a populist administration to come through over the weekend, and this time a left-wing populist. That's, I think, an important consideration as well from when one looks at the Mexican peso, that it had fallen and then unwound some of its oversold condition. Well, now we're starting to see the dollar firming up again, and this is on a day when the dollar was weak against a significant number of other currencies. And when we look at, for example, a Latin American fund, for example, I'm thinking about the Latin America, the JP Morgan Latin America, and let me think, I think maybe it's just LAT. That's not right. Okay, well, let's just look at that one. This is a Latin America ETF, and we see the clear break of the progression of higher reaction lows. So I think that's something that we're definitely seeing the negative connotations that this the strength of the dollar has had on just about all emerging markets, and not least because there is a lot of outstanding US dollar debt. What was interesting today was that the Chinese have banned new issuance of US dollar debt. Well, the alternative is that companies are going to have to issue local currency debt, but how possible is that going to be when the government is leaning on the banking sector? And that is going to have some knock-on effects for high yield, not just in the US, but just about everywhere else too. Well, if we get the dollar starting to weaken, well, that's probably going to put upward pressure on government bond yields, but it would act as a tailwind for the emerging markets. And we do have short-term oversold conditions, so there is ample potential for some of these markets to bounce in here. Then, of course, you have the oil price, and oil was resurgent this week. Well, the longer-term picture for oil is that it's going to range, but the range could be decades in the making, and in between that the formation of that range, you're going to have moves that are cyclical in nature. Well, Brent crude is coming back up towards the $80 level, and it's done so this week in a dynamic manner. I'll just put up the contract tables for both Brent crude which is trading in a very mild backwardation, but WTI is trading in a rather wide backwardation, and there is not far off a $2 difference between the September and the August contracts. So you can see that there's a rather steep imbalance between the front end and the next parts of the curve. And that's contributing to the continued relative strength of the energy sector. And West Texas Intermediate broke out to new recovery highs this week and continues to extend its advance. And it's being driven by lower US stockpiles. The quantity of oil that the USA is exporting is up to approximately 3 million barrels a day. They're still importing approximately 5 million barrels, but there is the realistic possibility that if the USA really wanted to be, it could be energy independent. And they have lots of additional supply, and it's starting to put pressure on export infrastructure and the infrastructure that it needs to put in place to get the oil from the Permian to the refineries and export facilities on the coast is only a matter of time before that starts to come in. But oil prices starting to move higher in a dynamic manner. Well, we're not at a point where oil prices are accelerating higher, but this is a bullish pattern, and it does suggest that we're going to have the energy sector doing better. But a surging oil price is one of the other things that we look at as a potential lead indicator for trouble in the economy. So if we do get oil prices surging higher, most particularly if oil prices start to surmount that $100 level again, well, then people are going to start seeing it in their pockets on a practically global basis. And that is going to be of particular interest to the major importers of oil, because the USA is now a major exporter of oil. It's likely to be less of an influence on the USA than it is for places like Europe and China. And it's Europe and China that are already underperforming. So when we think about where is the risk? Well, if we're thinking about risk and not just on a short-term basis and not just on a national or a local basis, well, the risk is in China and the risk is in Europe, and Europe is highly dependent on China. So the big economies in Europe are major exporters, and China is a much larger consumer of European exports than it is of US exports. If China does in fact roll over, if the Communist Party cannot meet its grandiose ambitions and messes up and creates a recession, the first recession in years, well, that is going to have reverberations all over the world, but of course, most particularly on the economies that are most dependent on China. Well, that is, I think, an important consideration, because one of the points that we've made over the course of the last few years is that Wall Street is in a secular bull market, and the Dow Gold ratio continues to march higher from the low that we saw in 2011. And the peaks in that ratio are approximately 35 years apart, and we have over 100 years of data. And we are in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and that's not a situation that's going to last indefinitely. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the next big problem that we come to is going to be a US problem. It might be a problem somewhere else. And therefore, that could contribute to a cyclical bear market on Wall Street within the context of a secular bull market, but it needn't necessarily represent a crash. But it doesn't mean you're not going to get a crash somewhere. And I think that's something that is not getting enough of due consideration, that people tend to have very localized views of where the risks are. And the real risks that are outstanding today are there are obviously challenges that the USA is going to have to deal with, considering that it is adopting massive fiscal stimulus at a really rather mature stage of the cycle, and that liabilities and debt GDP are on an upward trajectory. But one of the other important considerations, and it's something that people have been talking about with regard to Japan for a long time, is that a lot of the USA's debt is held internally. Now, it's got an awful lot of debt, and a lot of and if you look at the absolute figures, well, then Japan and China own a lot of that debt. But if you look at debt as a percentage of GDP, more than 80% of it is held internally, and that insulates the USA to a certain extent. It does not insulate the kinds of countries that have got their debt denominated in US dollars. And these are, I think, important considerations. And when we think about the relative performance of markets, then I don't think it's appropriate to look at those that are exhibiting relative strength as those that are susceptible to the biggest declines. It's rather those that are already trending lower are where the greatest risk is, because we know that this market has been fueled by liquidity. And we know that liquidity conditions are tightening. Therefore, it makes sense that the markets that are underperforming when liquidity conditions are starting to tighten are probably those that were most dependent on liquidity. And right now, it's Europe and China are exhibiting the greatest underperformance, and then you've got the emerging markets that are coming in behind. But it is Wall Street and the USA are exhibiting relative strength. Well, that tells us that the risks are less in the USA and more elsewhere. I think that is perhaps one of the bigger conclusions that we can draw right now, even if there are significant challenges for the USA down the line. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.